Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to the Sans Pants Network,
home of comedy,
culture, adventures,
and ghosts.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George Dimbrellis. This is a show where we ask you, what's your story and what does it say about you? Today on the show, we have the author of A Tiger in Eden, The Glass Kingdom, and most recently, Mammoth, a book released in tandem with a new exhibit at Victoria Museum, where he is the editor-in-chief. He's written for more publications than I can name right here. Chris Flynn, a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hello, George. Nice to see you.
You too. Yes, I guess great to have you on. You've written a bunch of books. You write constantly, and you're like a part of it. It's an interesting difference from the author side of things, being the editor for the Victoria Museum. Where did that start? I want to just ask about that first off.
Right. That's fairly recent. Basically, in a very strange, unprecedented turn of events, when Mammoth came out, because Mammoth is all about fossils that are on sale at an auction and, you know, museums are trying to acquire them and they get sort of outbidded by celebrities. It didn't occur to me at the time, although it probably should have, that a lot of people who work at museums went and read the book. And
makes sense.
So I got an email about a year ago out of the blue from a head of exhibitions at Melbourne Museum. And he wanted me to come in for a meeting. And I didn't really know what it was about. It was all very vague. And I just thought they wanted to consult with me on something. But when I got there, I'm in this meeting with all these smiling faces looking at me, and they'd all read Mammoth. And they wanted me to come in because they had just bought a triceratop, which is 67 million years old and is now on show at Melbourne Museum. But at the time, it was just being cleaned. The fossil was being cleaned in Canada and was going to be transported to Melbourne during the pandemic. And they wanted someone, because in Mammoth, I give voice to the fossils. They wanted to hire me to create a voice and personality for the 67 million year old triceratops skeleton they had just acquired. And that led to me being appointed editor in residence in there and to help create a suite of books to accompany the exhibit. So there's four Triceratops books that got created, one of which I wrote and one of which I was the editor on. And now, weirdly, I find myself with a desk at the museum speaking to actual paleontologists and clever people looking out over the exhibition building in Melbourne. I don't really know how this has happened in my life.
That's amazing. Okay, so I mean, straight away, I actually did butcher a little bit the intro. So I thought Mammoth was written actually as part of that. So you're saying that was before, and it's Horridus, the new one that's part of.
Yes. Right. Mammoth came out in 2020. It was sort of, I had written two books before. You mentioned them at the top, and they hadn't done great. And Mammoth was my sort of last gasp attempt at like trying to do a weird, funny book that pleased me, and I didn't think anyone else would be bothered with it. And it ended up doing really well and finding quite a wide audience. And so that led to me getting this job and creating the books for Horridus. So Jesus, you just really can't tell where writing a book's going to land you, really.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a best case scenario for you. Like really, that worked out very well.
It sort of is because my fascination as an artist is the sort of byways and alleyways of history and the, you know, forgotten people and, you know, strange tales that don't get talked about that much, which I sort of packed that stuff into Mammoth. And now I find myself in a museum that has, I don't know, 21 million objects or something, most of them in storage that, you know, people haven't seen for decades. And there's all these literally millions of stories in there waiting to be told. So it's like, I'll never have to come up with an idea ever again.
And I mean, and like, to be honest, I read Mammoth when it was sent out to me, and I thought it was a really good way of doing that, because it was a really engaging way of having characters involved to give like voice to these moments. And yeah, I thought it was really entertaining. Like, this does explain, because as I was reading it, I thought it was part of the Victoria Museum. I was like, where's the Victoria Museum in this? And then it goes on this, you focus on the Irish immigrants in America side of things as well. And I was like, this seems not what I expected based on what I thought was the thing. So this makes a lot more sense to me
this
now.
This is making more sense to you now.
Project. I mean,
it's pretty rare that Mammoth actually makes sense to anyone. So if you say it's starting to make sense to you, I'm pleased about that.
it's a unique way of doing that. I really liked it. So let's start off with your book of choice for today. We can jump around and definitely talk about Mammoth more and your previous books. It's called Bookish. We're going to have plenty of people who are very interested in your author experiences. But let's start with that. So your book of choice for today is?
I Am Legend by Richard Matheson, 1954.
A classic, sci-fi classic. Not just because of the recent movie. It's actually been made into movies three times, I think. So that's how
it has. It has. There was a Vincent Price movie version, a black and white Vincent Price version, which was kind of the most faithful to the book. And then famously in the 60s, or maybe it was this, maybe it might even be the early 70s, Charlton Heston starred in The Omega Man, which was a version of it that was very odd, because it's Charlton Heston, the arch Republican, as a sort of hippie survivalist. And I saw it when I was very young and thought it was amazing, because they shot it, a lot of the scenes, very early in the morning in LA on a Sunday morning in the 70s, and the city looked empty. And that was a really sort of compelling thing for me, as I suppose it probably always has been for a lot of us, this fantasy of being the only person, you know, around in a city or town and walking around. And then, of course, it happened for real to everyone. So yeah. I feel like I Am Legend was very prescient in many ways.
Yeah. So I guess for people to just get a quick summary of the story, for people who haven't maybe read or seen the book, and I'll just very briefly, basically, there's a last man alive. There's a virus that's gone around and infected everyone else, and they've become a variation on vampires. And it's the story of this man's survival on his own with these quote unquote vampires in it. Mm. And then kind of towards the end, there is quite an interesting twist that happens. I feel like we're going to have to spoil this one, because the ending is so
we probably will. I mean, most people have probably seen the Will Smith movie version, you know, where he roams the post-apocalyptic world, slapping people on the mouth. But
that happened once. You had to do that.
Yeah, that's right. I had to make a Will Smith reference. The Will Smith movie, whilst, you know, looked great and everything, it did deviate quite strongly from the ending. And in the book, quite a sort of sad, sort of terrifying tale of a man who's just barricaded inside his house. He's a scientist and he doesn't quite understand what's happened to everyone. His neighbors have all transformed into these nocturnal bloodsucker type people that seem like vampires, but he doesn't really believe it. He doesn't believe any of the myths. But they assemble every night around his house at the bottom of his garden and just chant his name, Neville, Neville. And he has to drink whiskey and crank up the music on his stereo just to try and blot them out. And then during the day, he roams the streets looking for survivors and also testing out his theories on these sleeping people by, you know, trying garlic out on them and seeing if that affects them, or he ends up just staking loads of them through the heart. And he slowly comes around to the notion that they might be some kind of vampire. And he was bitten by a bat or something when he was very young. And so he's the only one who's immune to it. But the sad thing about the book is that he's absolutely destroyed by loneliness. And he becomes so hell-bent on destroying these sort of sick people as he sees them, they're sick, that he just misses the truth of the matter. And that is that society has actually moved on. And whilst he is locked in his house at night, yes, there's these people sort of moaning and groaning outside his house, but there's a whole society out there that's operating where people have adapted to being nocturnal and having sort of desire for blood. And they've just moved on and he's unaware of it. And he's actually the monster in their midst, because during the day he's out roaming around killing them. So he just hasn't adapted to the new changing world, and he's clutching on to the old one. And of course, eventually they hunt him down and he realizes the error of his ways, but it's too late by then.
Yeah, he finds out that he's actually the monster, like in it all, because he's refusing to change or accept that things have moved on from where he was, which is a very thematically rich theme, I think, and it's absolute sucker punch for everyone who would have read it the first time. Please. So I guess before going into anything else, why is this? Why'd you pick this book? I don't know. It's an impossible question when I ask people favorite book, but why did this one spring to mind?
No, it sort of keeps recurring in my life. I read it quite young, probably at that sort of teenage age of angst, and it sort of appealed to me, this idea of, you know, being alone and trying to cope with that. And, you know, you can't identify with the people around you, and this sort of really compelling fantasy of just everyone being gone and you have the city or town to yourself, which everyone got to indulge themselves a little bit in that fantasy during COVID lockdowns, I suppose. You know, we all would have spent, you know, some time wandering the streets, probably by yourself, no one around. And I think it sort of taught me a little bit about change and how to deal with it and not be afraid of it. And I've lived in a lot of different countries and have worked so many different jobs in my life and always had to kind of adapt to survive. I'm quite good at that. You know, I learned a few languages and moved on and, you know, quite good at taking care of myself and not being afraid of when things change. And I think it's kind of been a book that's prepared me quite well for the modern world of uncertainty that we live in. So I am fond of it. And I recently spent like $100 and bought a very beautiful edition of it. That's by the Folio Society in the UK. They only print a certain number of books, but it's beautifully illustrated. And I read it. It's a little bit dated. It's written in the 50s, but geez, the themes are pretty compelling. And that ending is still an absolute killer.
I just want to point out to everyone who can't see that you just picked up the book there, the Folio Society book next to you, which it looks fancy. It does.
It is.
Yeah. So I guess to relate to the stuff, were you writing even back then? Did you start writing late? Was that part of the appeal as well, just seeing a book that's well-written and engaging in that way?
Yeah. I mean, I was always a writer, even when I was a kid. I sort of escaped into the library as a kid. I grew up in Belfast and it wasn't at the height of the Troubles and it wasn't like the greatest place in the world. And
that's an understatement. And, yeah. Not the greatest. Second greatest, but yeah.
Second greatest, maybe after Dingle. Yes, that's right. I know you're a Dingle man. So
I said, my cousin married an Irishman. I've spent plenty of time in Dingle. Love it. Great. There you go. More pubs than people, that place.
That's right. Classic West Coast Irish town, really. So my parents were illiterate. And so we had no books in the house. So sorry, we had three books in the house. We had the Illustrated Bible and we had A.A. Milne's The House at Pooh Corner. And we had William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist. So those were the first three books that I read.
Okay. It's an interesting range in that.
Yes, somehow, there is.
I do feel like those kind of relate to I Am Legend somehow.
Yeah, you're probably right. The sort of demonic possession, Yeah, that's right. So I found libraries as a refuge when I was quite young, and the librarian sort of took me in and would recommend books to me and advance me to the adult section quite early. And so I was always books for my escape from, I suppose, the sort of misery of the world around me at the time. And always was a writer when I was traveling in my 20s and 30s and never really took it too seriously. You know, I had the classic sort of writing your poetry and your moleskin diary whilst you're traveling sort of period. But then in Australia, I eventually thought, well, maybe I've got a couple of books in me here, and sat down to try and write them. And it took me a while, but my first book came out just before my 40th birthday. And I read something at the time that said the average age of a first-time author is actually quite old. It's 42. That may have changed a little bit now. That might have come down a little bit, but most people actually struggle to get a book published in their 20s and 30s. And those that do tend to get, you know, promoted quite a bit. So it probably gives a bit of a false impression. And I just turned 50 recently. So I'm up to three adult books, two kids books, and I've got a second kids book coming out this year. And my fourth book for adults comes out later this year. So I think I'm doing all right, and I now seem to be actually able to make it happen. There's enough people who have read my books now that there is a small appetite for them. So, and my very odd brand of historical, curious, humorous weirdness seems to have enough of an audience that publishers will still entertain me at their door.
Well, yeah, that's what I found interesting, because when I was looking over your previous written books, and it's interesting because, like, now I'm sitting here making the connection with something like I Am Legend as well, because in a weird way, I haven't read those ones yet, but they seem like the first one is about an experience in Thailand and trying to survive in Thailand with some dodgy stuff going on. Was that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, A Tiger in Eden. Yeah, that's right. It was just about a young Irish guy who was trapped in Thailand and couldn't really leave for various reasons, and him trying to work how to be a good person during that time. And the second one was set on a traveling carnival going up the east coast of Australia, set in the sort of carny world and the sort of small-time petty crime that sort of circulates around that world. And I did work very briefly on a traveling fair. So those early books. Yeah, I had a weird job on that, man. I had, you know, those sumo wrestling outfits that you zip kids into and then they fight each other?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in charge of that. I was the referee. I was dressed like a referee, and I had to make the kids fight each other and then break them up when it got out of hand.
Amazing. That's an interesting job. You turned it into a book, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, well, so those first two books, there was, you know, an element of me channeling things that had happened to me to a degree, but then exaggerating them and turning them into something else. But then Mammoth is a complete departure from that. And that in itself is a bit of a confusing thing sometimes for readers. You know, there's this sort of expectation that once you've done a certain type of book, you're just going to do something similar next time. And I've done three quite different books, and my fourth book's different again. So one of my friends, who's a mechanic down here on the Basque Coast where I live, he said to me, how can anyone know what they're going to get from you? And it's a fair point, you know. But yeah. I don't want to do the same thing all the time. God, no.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. You got to write what you feel like writing, basically. Mm, so that makes sense.
That's right.
Yeah, that's what I thought was interesting, because the first two do seem like much more human, like quite dark, like adult in the sense of like there's drugs and all that stuff going on. And then Mammoth was quite a bit of a departure in some ways, because it was obviously just these moments in history from the point of view of a 65 million old mammoth.
You're thinking of the Triceratops that's 67 right. million years old. The Mastodon is 13,000 years old. They're fairly recent. Yeah.
Yeah. What am I talking about? A woolly mammoth. Ugh. It's like I didn't even. I read the book. I did. That sounds like I didn't. Yes. The most recent ice age. That's where they suffered.
That's right. Yeah.
The reason I find that is because, like, it's so those first ones had a much more of a human on the ground element, and then this one was much more science based and like it showed a love of science and history, which is two things that I very much enjoy as well. That's why I think I liked the putting the characters in there. So were those elements of the first two books, or was it more this was a focus of what you wanted to do right now? Because that science element, yeah, it didn't seem like that was as big a part of these.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, those early books, they exist, they came out, they found a small audience, but they didn't do great. And now I don't really think about them that much anymore. It's almost like Mammoth was like the reinvention of me as an author. And, you know, my next book will be more in that vein, and so will the one after that. I've sort of found the things that I'm interested in now seem to be, I'm able to channel them into the books, and I'm interested in a lot of different things. And they're books of ideas where I sort of throw a lot of things in there and have a lot of diversions and indulge my brain in looking at odd little moments in history. And it seems to work for me. I suddenly don't anguish as much over the writing of them as I did with the very human stories. I'm probably not great at telling human stories. Or telling them through the prism of being a human. I kind of like the external observer on humanity. I think that's a bit easier for me to get my head around for some reason.
Mm. I think, isn't there, I'm sure there's a quote somewhere I could remember where like any writer's first book is always about them. Because it always takes a few books for you to like find your voice of what you actually like outside of that, because you're just speaking to your own experience the first time. So
right, and that is you know probably largely true. It does create some difficulties in the modern publishing world because you're not given as much chance to develop your career anymore as it used to be. I mean, there's plenty of authors who never hit their straps until their sixth or seventh book, but now, you know, even getting that far is quite a difficult achievement. You know, the industry tends to focus a lot on debut authors and then you never hear from them again. There's not as much support for the development of a career in publishing as there used to be, I don't think. So, you know, being dogged, and I know plenty of people who had a great first book out and had what sounded like a cool idea for a second book, and it never happened because, you know, their first book didn't sell well enough or they couldn't. There's this sort of misconception that once you're in, but you're not. You're sort of in and then you're out immediately and you have to try and get back in again. So every book you have to reconvince publishers that it'll be okay, it's gonna work, I know what I'm doing. And they're like, do you though? You know, unless you've got hundreds of thousands of sales, they're usually pretty skeptical. So you do have to reconvince them each time of the merit of what you're doing. It's not like you'd say, oh, I've got a couple of other ideas here on the back burner, I'll just chuck them your way and you'll publish them for me, right? No, that's not how it works.
Is that like a Australian thing, or is that just like a global way it is now?
I think globally it's sort of become that way now, and you do have to start again from scratch a little bit each time, which is incredibly frustrating. And you get forgotten pretty quickly, you know. So if you have 5 or 6 years between books, by the time your next one comes out, people will be like, who the hell is that?
I know, it's criminal. Like, who's good straight away? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's very rare. So people just love that story, but it's like, it takes a few goes around to really start perfecting your style.
Of course. In any artistic discipline, you know, you need to be able to, you know, foster your practice over a number of years and get good at it. You know, you don't just pick up the violin and you're like a virtuoso immediately. So, and I think writers don't get much of a chance for that anymore. You're kind of expected, like large things are expected of you right from the beginning. And if you don't deliver, then, you know, good luck, buddy, in getting your second book up. And, you know, and authors face that, you know, difficult second album syndrome as well, where they pour all their energy for years into their first book. And then it does well. And the publisher's like, so book two, that's ready to go, right? And they're like, what? What do you mean? And they have to go on. Record 10 songs in the space of, you know, 6 weeks, and it's a disappointment to everyone.
It's very different. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's always that first one. You've got your whole life building up to the first one, and the next one's like 2 years. Like, okay,
yes, that's right. Yeah,
and exactly dealing with all like these new things that have happened because of the first one you've released. So
that's right.
Yeah, I can imagine it's complicated. So with in terms of the science angle, now that you've gone and these little stories and the historical things, was this part of like? It sounds like that relates to your library experience as well, because maybe you're in there reading, but obviously somewhere like a library, you're going to be getting a lot of fun facts about a lot of different things.
Yes, yes. And I did read a lot of nonfiction in the library and, you know, history books about, you know, periods that I wasn't learning about in school, you know, because in school it's very prescribed and, you know, you're like, well, you're going to learn about the Tudors or whatever. Oh, God, that's great, you know. But what you really want to learn about is the Vikings. So so you have to go and do that research yourself. And that probably is what led me to this point as well. It's funny to think of the things that form you as an artist. And I often think it's, in my case, it's just such a multiplicity of influences, not just weird history books from the library, but, you know, horror books that I would flick through looking for dirty bits, you know, and you know, 70s movies and Depeche Mode or just like the video games, PlayStation games. There's so many different things that have influenced me in my life. So it's often quite hard to pinpoint the origin of something. And it's a bit of a tricky moment for authors because, you know, you do often get asked questions like, you know, how did you come up with this idea? What a question. You might as well say, how does your brain work? Can you please explain it to me? And it's sometimes impossible to, and so you end up with these fairly rote answers that, you know, are a bit pat and aren't a very good summation of the truth. And I have a terrible tendency as an Irish storyteller to go off piste, and as you've probably already realized in this interview, and answer questions in a variety of different ways. So the same question, I'm sure if you look back through interviews of mine, you'll see I've answered the same question, you know, 10 different ways. And with Mammoth, there was so much for me to talk about with that book that there's certain interviews where I talked about some aspects of it and didn't mention all this other all these other things that happened. But then other interviews, I would focus on one of these other little things. And if you listen to all the interviews, you'd think I was talking about 12 different books.
Yeah. Well, I mean, something like Mammoth, it does cover a broad range of things within it. So yeah, I could see how easily you could fall into that.
But that's also very useful when it comes to promoting a book. And I realized that, you know, through my experience in the, I was at an event at the Melbourne Writers Festival once, just sitting in the audience, and Kamila Shamsi, who's the Pakistani English author, she had a book out called Burnt Leaves, which was partly set in Japan just after the Americans had dropped the atomic bomb. And it was a very serious book, and it was, you know, in consideration for a lot of prizes and so on. And she had a big crowd, and I was sitting in the crowd, and it was all going great. And then right at the end, audience questions, which is always a schmozzle. And some woman in the audience said, I love these sections set in Japan. How long did you live there? Kamila Shamsi said, oh, I've never been to Japan. And there's a collective gasp from the crowd. She's never been. And yet she wrote about it. Oh, and she lost them. She lost the audience. And at the end of the event, most people just walked out, and hardly anyone wanted to come and get a book signed. And I thought, and as an audience member, I was like, oh, okay. Oh, she made a mistake there. She basically said she just looked it all up on the internet, which is what everyone does, right? You know, you don't have to go and live in post-World War II Japan to be qualified to write about it. But so, yeah, she got herself in a bit of a tight corner there. And since then, I always thought, you know what? It's good to have non-fiction real stories to tell when you're talking about a book, because people can then get their head around it. So when it came to something like Mammoth, I thought, if I'm just going to tell people it's a bunch of talking fossils, they'll be out. They won't be interested. But if I can talk about the real humans and the real historical things behind it and the odd facts that I uncovered, then it makes it more compelling. And sure enough, when that book came out, the ABC were all over me, because it's just so easy to be a guest on then on some ABC, the science show or whatever, because you can talk about cloning, you can talk about President Jefferson. There's all these different things, real world things that you can talk about that relate to your book. So I'm glad I kind of worked that one out because otherwise it would seem like a very tough premise to sell.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, I'll be honest, my gut reaction when I heard you telling that story just then, I was like, oh, she hasn't been and she's writing all this stuff. But then I thought about it for 3 seconds. I'm like, wait a second. If you were just writing about a fantasy world or a time back before the last 20 years, you haven't been there either. You're basing this on, research and looking into the accounts of people.
Right. And that, so, and Kamila Shamsi is an incredibly intelligent woman. So, you know, I'm sure she did her due diligence and research into what it was like for victims or survivors of the atomic blast in Japan. She didn't just make it up off the top of her head. But why is that not? Why is her research not respected? You know, it's, but that sort of speaks to you know, more general difficult themes in the literary world these days about appropriation and who has the right to tell stories and so on, which are very legitimate but are very divisive as well.
Yeah, I've heard some people talk about that. It is a good conversation to have, but obviously it should always be done where anyone can tell any story, but don't be lazy about it. That's all. Like, make sure you do the research and stuff. So
that's the sort of bottom line that comes out of that argument is like, all right, you can write whatever you want, sure, but don't fuck it up. Don't do something stupid and just dash it off, you know, which is always a risk.
Yeah, exactly.
And I had to be really careful about that stuff with, you know, doing these historical books, because there's so many, you know, nerds out there who will pick it apart and say, well, actually, you said President Jefferson was there on 14th of July and he was only there until the 12th of July. So you're wrong.
That's hilarious. All right. Well, so to go on another tangent now, and I didn't know about your upbringing in Belfast during the Troubles. It's obviously a very intense time, and it would make sense that a story about survival would be something that appeals to you. So there's kind of two themes there that I want to kind of unpack. One is, you mentioned already this feeling of loneliness, and I guess because of my experience only with Mammoth, having read that, but that feeling of loneliness obviously is, if you're a 13,000-year-old mastodon, you're going to feel that sense of loneliness. And you kind of do capture that a little bit in the book without going into it in like too far down that path. But obviously that's a major feature of I'm Legend as well. So is that something you felt, and did that resolve itself naturally? Was there a thing involved in that journey for you?
No, that's a good question. And basically, I think I was quite a precocious sort of child and I didn't quite understand how I had come from my parents. Even at a very young age, I thought, why am I here in this place? This doesn't seem right. I seem to have been born in the wrong place. And I used to joke about it with my parents and say, you know, did you find me in a glowing orb at the end of a long furrow in a field and raise me as your son? Or was there a mistake at the hospital? Was there, you know, the Romanian ambassador was in town and there was a mistake with the babies? Like, it just made no sense that I was there. I seemed so different from them. And, you know, it's a bit of a generational thing too, but I never really felt like I belonged in Belfast and felt like a real fish out of water, ironically, you know, in the place where I was. It probably didn't help that it was, you know, blood and guts on the news every night and people getting blown up and shot and, you know, kids I went to school with died or tortured or all sorts of, you know, nasty shit. You know, I grew up in a war zone, and it's funny how it affects you because you become a bit deadened to it. You kind of have to get used to hearing horrible news every day, because if you don't, you know, develop a coping mechanism, you're not going to make it. You know, you'll be messed up for life. So it kind of washes over you after a while. And I didn't really understand that until I left there. As soon as I turned 18, I was like, I'm gone. And I lived in Scotland and France initially. And I remember one time, I think I was in England, and there was some news story about someone had been murdered, and everyone at work where I was working in a data entry place were really upset, even though they didn't know the person. It wasn't even in the same town. And I thought, why are they upset about this murder? And then I realized that I was sort of dead inside to that kind of thing. It just didn't affect me. And I started to notice that other things about violence and so on didn't really have any effect on me either. I mean, I grew up around a lot of guns because obviously there was the army, the British army were on the streets, you know, helicopters landing in the field, disgorging troops, and the police force there were heavily armed. You know, I had police officers hold a gun to my head for a laugh whenever I was a child, that sort of thing. So, you know, and I saw a lot of guns. My next door neighbor, we had these neighbors who moved in, and their father was a policeman, and he let us play with his guns. And he thought it was funny. So you just get used to horror a little bit. And being Irish, you kind of resort to humor and banter and, you know, at times like that, because they're coping mechanisms, right? And it's probably why I'm still a bit like that today. You know, I laugh in the face of danger, but I sort of do a bit. And I sort of think if someone pulled a gun on me now in a public space, everyone else would be ducking for cover, and I'd probably just roll my eyes and go, okay, so are you going to put that down? Are you going to give it to me? Or am I going to take it from you? How's this going to play? You know, I just probably wouldn't have the same reaction that a lot of other people would have.
Yeah, it'd be like, I'm home again.
Yeah, that's right. So the loneliness part of it, I did feel quite lonely there, that I didn't belong there. And I always knew I would leave. I was just killing time until I could leave, and never really went back, to be honest. You know, the occasional visit, my father died last year from COVID. My mum's still alive, and although she's got Alzheimer's and probably wouldn't recognize me if she saw me, but so they're pretty old and I don't really have much connection there anymore. So yeah, Ireland is an odd one for me. People have a very patriotic sense of the place where they grew up often, and a strong sort of spiritual connection to places like Ireland that seem sort of jovial and happy. But for me up in the north, it wasn't great, and I don't have a great love for the place. And really pisses me off whenever I meet someone and they're like, oh, you're Irish, do you like U2, the River Dance? I'm like, you'll like my fist in your face in a second.
Okay, I was going to be changing my next question now. So, no, well, it's interesting you're saying that, because like with Mammoth specifically, you the story almost takes quite a turn. I felt like almost halfway through, and becomes very much an Irish tale about immigrants traveling. So it's funny you're saying this, as like your most recent book seems to have quite almost focus on the Irish element of immigration, which I didn't think would go hand in hand.
It does, and I probably didn't see that coming either. And when it happened, I was like, oh, looks like I'm doing this. I wasn't expecting to take a little jaunt into Ireland and talking about the Irish diaspora and the idea of Irish people trying to survive outside of Ireland, I've often said Mammoth has got nothing to do with me as a person, but maybe it actually really does speak to something very important to me, which is this idea of what does it mean to be removed from your country and your homeland, and how do you then relate to that going forward? I still, do struggle with ideas of Irish nationality, and still got my passport and sort of a little bit proud of that, but also at the same time, I don't know if I would ever live there again. But who knows? We don't know. I didn't see any of this coming, so yeah. God knows where I'll be in 5 years.
No, you did not expect to be the editor for the Victoria Museum, so yeah.
No, I did not know that was going to happen.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, but it's like, so there's such an Irish element in the book to be like, oh, I didn't really think and notice it. It's a bit of yourself in there, I feel like.
There is, and because the book features so many real historical personages and real historical events, the Irish brother and sister in the book, whom I specifically gave very difficult to pronounce Gaelic names and didn't explain them until the end, which kind of annoyed a lot of people because they'd been saying them wrong the whole time. It's Kiva and Conacher, although they're strange spellings.
Yeah, that's not how it, yeah.
Well, Kiva is C-A-O-I-M-H-E. How annoying is that? And Conacher, which is the old form of Connor, is C-O-N-C-H-O-B-H-A-R. So
of course it is.
There's no actual K or V in either of those names, but it sounds like there are. But that whole section with them traveling up the river, going after the Lewis and Clark expedition to try and catch up to them to sell them mammoth bones, that followed very closely my research into the Lewis and Clark expedition. So there's specific parts of the river are described in that are lifted almost verbatim from the Lewis and Clark diaries. But the Irish brother and sister, siblings, they're two of the only invented characters in the book. And people are terribly disappointed when they find that out. So many people have commented on that section of the book as being their favorite part of it and are just devastated to find out that Kiva didn't actually exist. Although she is representative of a lot of Irish women of that time, so that's my excuse. But I am taking that to heart, and my next novel that I'm working on now, I'm researching at the moment, I am going to satisfy readers who enjoyed that part of the book, and I'm going to play ball this time and give them what they want.
Nice. Well, you know, if you have to, you know.
That's right.
So to go on for another tangent now, because talking about the book Mammoth, and again, this is a bit different, and funny enough, it does actually. I Am Legend was an excellent choice to relate stuff together here, because the other side of this is obviously the extinction level event that happens in I Am Legend, which also is traced through a Mammoth very clearly. And I think I'm sure people have done many associations between that and the current state of the planet with climate change and all that. Was these concerns stuff that you have, or is this just like a cool idea because you like the sci-fi element, which would be fine if that's it, or is it something else?
Just a long-term obsession with extinction and the end of the world, and when is it going to happen? Hurry up. Hurry up. I can't wait to be the guy in I Am Legend, you know. But
we could unpack that for hours, I feel like, but yeah.
That's right. Yeah, you could. The climate change aspect, and obviously the Mammoth is, you know, part of the megafauna. There's sections in the book set towards the end of the Ice Age, when, you know, us irritating humans have turned up and started to dramatically alter the landscape about, you know, 12, 13,000 years ago, when we got a little bit smart, a little bit clever clogs, and started to, you know, murder everything in sight and build huts from the skins and bones of animals and started lighting fires, cutting down forests, burning everything, and the planet got hotter and all the animals died.
Well, I don't think it was human. Yeah. It wasn't human caused the planet getting hotter. Well, that was a cycle, right?
Well, that's right. There's different viewpoints, scientific viewpoints, on whether how much the arrival of humans had on the climate of the planet back then, or whether it was going through a natural cycle anyway. We probably didn't help, because we never really do. We always seem to make things worse everywhere we go. Yeah. Probably lighting all those fires probably didn't help. But, and you know, you fast forward.
Probably change of the vegetation everywhere, because we would have done some. I read a book called Guns. Have you read Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Dunn? Oh, that's a great book about like looking at that period specifically and how that influenced us today, and like how we formed from those early ancestors. And it's talking about things like the large scale, which I think indigenous cultures here in Australia did quite a bit, but it was kind of a thing that happened where we reshaped the land almost naturally because of the way we would farm, quote unquote, because we would just be picking these seeds and then they would drop in a certain way, which would then actually naturally kind of develop. So yeah, it could be. I could see it on a large scale enough, I suppose. I don't know if we were that many people, though, that's all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there wasn't a lot of people around, but they certainly did kill a lot of animals, because it was just a smorgasbord of creatures just waiting to be slaughtered. And yeah, I've heard that. And they had no real fear of the humans. So there were a couple of million mammoths, and in a short space of time, there were none. And they were performing a job, the mammoths, in that the huge mega herds were circulating the northern part of the globe, which where the land mass was all sort of linked, is the great sort of steppe. And so it was cold and dry, because they would just stomp down the snow and the ice and it kept the ground cold and hard and sort of served a little bit as the Earth's refrigerator.
And so it's very clear impact then, yeah.
And then whenever we killed them all, they weren't able to do that anymore, so everything started to melt. And
wow.
Yeah, which is why they're trying to bring them back.
For that purpose again. Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that in the book. I was like, is that actually what they're thinking about doing to try to get...
It so is. There's a couple of documentaries you can watch because they've recovered viable DNA from mammoths' carcasses that have thawed out in Siberia. You can see, you know, people cutting bits of flesh off the mammoth, and like some guy cuts a bit of flesh off the mammoth and eats it because he wants to be the first person in 13,000 years to have eaten mammoth. Doesn't even check to see what parasites or diseases it might be in it, and they're bleeding, some of them. So
wow.
They have viable DNA, and there's you know, synthetic biology labs in Korea, China, and in Harvard, all of whom are currently working on resurrecting the mammoth from the dead, and other species too. So.
Yeah, but specifically for that ecological benefit.
Well, there's already a part of Russia, which, I mean, God knows what that's going to happen now, but there was a part of Russia set aside called Pleistocene Park, where they were going to release mammoths there. And once they actually grew them in the lab and raised them, and they would be raised by elephants and then release them there. And the idea was to rebuild the herds and see if they can get back to work, stomping down the snow and ice and try to lower the temperature in Siberia.
Yeah, what's left of the ice?
What's left of it?
Yeah.
That's it.
It's one of those things where everyone talks about humans being an extinction thing now, but it's like we've been doing that since we started, and we've been killing everything. Like, as in, it's less now that we actually killed more when we first started.
Yeah. We've been agents of chaos since we came along, right from the beginning, you know. So nothing much has changed.
No, yeah. And I guess which ties in with your fascination with. You might just be the last man on earth. Fingers crossed, you might get there.
Fingers crossed. It's a fantasy, but it's probably a poorly chosen one, because the reality of that would probably not be very pleasant.
Look, yeah, I imagine so. I mean,
it'd be fun for a while, but eventually you'd get pretty annoyed with it.
I feel like it. Like, you skateboard down enough empty streets or freeways, and then you'd be like, you know what? Yeah, it's... Maybe having someone else to see me do this sick kick.
I wish there was someone else here to see this. That's right.
Oh, nice. Well, I guess, is there anything else I want to kind of go into? I think we've kind of gone on. Oh, actually, one more thing, just again, randomly. This is a sci-fi book. Is a sci-fi something you enjoy, or is that like, and that ties in with your science appreciation, or is it just kind of whatever?
Yes, I've always been a sci-fi fan, and I do quite like so-called literary books that have the sort of sci-fi fantastical element. I probably would read more science fiction than I do literary fiction, and it is odd to think that I'm trying to straddle those worlds, because you daren't call something science fiction in Australian literature, because then it gets consigned to the dustbin and doesn't get respected. So you have to be a little bit careful about the nomenclature around this sort of thing.
It boggles my mind that when you think about, like, I mean, like, not that I want to discredit literature in the grand scheme. It's beautiful and amazing and I love it. But to dismiss the other one, though, seems just as much a mistake. I mean, I just reread Slaughterhouse-Five recently, and I was just like, it's just such a masterpiece. Like it's such a masterpiece that, yeah, to discount that as not being literary or anything is mind-blowing.
Yeah, and literary fiction in itself is a very niche genre. So I don't know what happened to make that the dominant art form, where that is somehow better than the other art forms, whether that's better than romance or crime or science fiction. There's probably a bit of insecurity behind it, because, you know, romance, crime, and science fiction sell a lot better than literary fiction generally. So there's a bit of jealousy going on there. But I'm quite pleased that I'm finding that sort of middle ground where, like, Mammoth sold really well. And then when we got some of the sales figures, the very in-depth ones, we realized that it had sold not so great in sort of inner urban areas, and sold really well in regional and rural areas. And so your educated, so-called educated classes probably poo-pooed it a little, but your real ordinary, genuine person, I'm like my mechanic friend who reads one book every 5 years. He's like, that was great. I really enjoyed it. You know?
Yeah.
So that appeals to me, that idea of, you know, getting books into the hands of people who think books are not for them. Mm. That books are exclusionary and, you know, and therefore, you know, smart people. I like to defuse that and get in underneath that a bit, but that can make you a little bit of a pariah in the industry, because most people who work in the industry are the very educated classes who decide what books get published, and they tend to publish the books that they want to read themselves and forget sometimes that they're running a business.
All right, we're finally getting to the juicy bits, burning on the publishing industry.
I shouldn't have said that. That's it. Takedown of the publishing industry. But it's...
Why, you know, not?
look, it's fair. You know, when you see some of the books that have been really successful in Australia in recent years, you know, Trent Dalton's book and Jane Harper and books like that, you know, they are a bit poo-pooed by the literary establishment, but they sell gangbusters to all sorts of people from all walks of life. So people do want to read books, and I think it's important that we are inclusive in a different kind of way when producing books. We mustn't forget the millions of people out there who actually enjoy reading, but who just can't find anything they like to read.
Mm. Yeah. No, please. We don't want them. Please. Just no. That's it.
God forbid we have sales that keep us alive for another few years.
Okay, well, look, I'll stop it there before we go too deep into this. You know, yeah. I need you publishing more books, so let's leave
that's
it
right. That. Let's not get me cancelled. Yep, that's right.
Yeah. So I guess one last thing. Do you want to shout out anything right now? People can follow you somewhere or people can check things out?
I have eschewed social media for years, but I am on Instagram, Fly the Falcon. It's a long story. And
you're Irish. You'll tell it. So
yes, that's right. I will. And I'll tell 20 other stories whilst I'm trying to tell that story. So yeah. There you go. And obviously I'm working at the museum. We're doing some books with Hordus, the Triceratops at the museum. And I have another, right, and you'll like this. I have another, my fourth adult book that I mentioned earlier is coming out in September. We did have a argument about the title. So I'll run the title by you and you can tell me whether you think it's a terrible title or a good one. The title is Here Be Leviathans.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's
so the issue is I mentioned it ages ago on an interview on late night ABC show, and the presenter said, Leviathans. What's that?
That was gonna be my next question. Like
right.
Yeah.
Like this is
yeah, you don't want to be insulting to an audience by being like, they don't know what that word means, but I feel like a lot of people might not.
Right. That's the problem. A lot of people probably won't know what a Leviathan is, which is it's a biblical sort of thing about a large sort of sea creature that rises from the depths, you know?
Yeah. And also and like sounds a lot like a reference to Moby Dick as well, right?
Right. Exactly. And it used to be on old maps. So they'd say on land, they'd say here be dragons because they didn't know what was there. And maybe here be Leviathans might be in the seas, you know?
All right.
So it's this idea that there's, you know, monsters that you haven't encountered yet. But of course it's now, we've decided to go ahead with that title. So some people will be like, okay, here be what now? I have no idea what that is. So there you go. Oh, I'm already creating a difficulty for myself.
Love but it. Yeah.
That is a book of nine, I hesitate to say short stories because a lot of them are very long, from the points of view of various animals and non-living things. So there's a grizzly bear who has eaten the brain of a teenager during a fun run and inherited his memories. There is a monkey test pilot in the 1950s, which is based on a true story. The first monkey to make it to space and back alive. There is an airline seat narrating the story about its average work day. There's a hotel room telling you the story of a couple that it's trying to help them conceive a child. There is, what else? A colony of platypodes or platypuses who rescue some German backpackers, but the platypodes can talk because they were experimented on in a lab in Brisbane and then released into the wild, and they're really Aussie. So those kind of tales really, that are very typically me, off-kilter sort of alternative views of humanity.
That's great. You're really testing out these publishers with their distaste for sci-fi. I love it.
I really am. I'm really pushing to see how far I can go with this before someone says, no, that's enough.
That's enough of you, Chris, then.
That's enough of you. You're done in this time.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being on. That was really fun. Yeah, so I guess that's it. So, yeah, cheers. Thanks for being on.
Thank you very much, George. It's a pleasure, even though you are a dingle man.
Okay, it sounds strange when you say it without the context of it being a town.
It does. It sounds wrong.
I'm a dingle man and proud. All right. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.